I'm Macy Chen.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, January the 19th, and on today's Pulse show, we're talking about Indigenous identity, in particular people who pretend to be Indigenous. We're talking with filmmaker Tamara Bell with Aboriginal People's Television Network about her new proposed legislation, the Indigenous Identities Act. First up, our news headlines. In our top story today, members of Peer Harm Reduction Workforce in the Downtown East Side have voted unanimously to join a union for the first time. The Canadian Union of Public Employees 1004 announced the vote that was successful on Monday for workers at the Portland Hotel Society. Peer workers at Insight, Washington Needle Depot, IOAT, and overdose prevention sites in the DTES have been, quote, instrumental in saving lives in the face of BC's overdose public health emergency, according to the union. According to Don Cumberland, who works at the Washington Needle Depot in East Hastings for 20 years, this is about respect and recognition. He said, quote, I hope this means that people doing the hard work on the ground saving lives every day will finally get the credit they deserve. Ballots from the vote were sealed because the Portland Hotel Society challenged union certification for its peer employees. That process was set aside because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now that vote has finally been counted and is expected the Labour Board will issue an official certification at some point this week. Welcome back. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver Cooperative Radio. I'm David Ball. Well, the world of Indigenous film and arts was rocked last December when one of the most famous filmmakers in the Indigenous community, Michelle Latimer, was questioned on her identity. Latimer had claimed she was Métis, Algonquin, and from Kitigan-Zipi First Nation. None of those nations said that they could vouch for any connections to them. She did a genealogical test that found she had a single ancestor dating back about 400 years. She said, quote, I know that when questions like these are raised, it hurts our entire community and undermines the years of hard work that so many have contributed towards raising Indigenous voices. I take responsibility for the strain this conversation is having on the people who have supported me. Well, that apology was not enough for many people in the film industry. One of those is Tamara Bell, a Haida filmmaker with the National Film Board as well as Aboriginal People's Television Network, who is launching a legislation she hopes can be picked up by a senator or parliamentarian called the Indigenous Identities Act to prevent identity fraud. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your proposed legislation, Tamara.
No problem.
Can we just kind of take a step back a bit and kind of go into the backstory of what sparked this for listeners who maybe don't know the backstory?
The backstory is what happened in December was that Michelle Latimer, who was the director of Trickster, was outed by a CBC reporter for not being Indigenous. And she then did a DNA test, and the DNA test revealed that she's actually not Indigenous, and that she might have Indigenous ancestry in the 1600s, but that is really not considered Indigenous enough for most people.
Now, to put it in context of how big she'd got in the Indigenous film world, like she was selected to produce, I think, the Inconvenient Indian, and I know that her own directors, like Dennis Goulet and another one, resigned in protest over this. This is a fairly huge deal.
It is a huge story. It was written in Variety. It's a tremendously large deal because she was hand-selected by a lot of people. She had the support of a tremendous amount of people who colluded in order to rise her stardom to another level. That opportunity, she rose, continuing her false identity, And she ended up winning awards. She ended up getting profiteering and making money. I estimated her income to be about $1 million when she discovered or began to say she's indigenous. So I did actually go and do an account of how much I believe she made from claiming false identity, which is about $1 million. And
a lot of that's public money, right? Like arts grants and film board grants and access kind of things to help foster an Indigenous Canadian film industry.
Yes, most of that money was specifically slated for Indigenous people. That money is specifically meant to encourage and to some degree create reconciliation within the media industry and create a level playing field for Indigenous people. So by her assuming Indigenous identity, she became elevated by all those around her, including some of our Indigenous people, who looked past the obvious issues that were arising.
Now, she has said throughout her career that she was Algonquin and Métis mixed, and she kept kind of changing or varying the way that she described herself, even as Métis, eventually settling on Kitigan-Zibi Nation in Quebec. But as far as we can tell from CBC's reporting, no one there has claimed her or claimed to know her ancestor of any sort.
Yes, and that's one of the things is that, say, for example, I were to have an issue in my community, I would immediately have elders step forward, whether I had a status card or not. If I was an intricate member or I was a fabric of that society, people would vouch for me. Nobody has vouched for me. Rather, they've requested apologies, including the Métis people have requested an apology from her. You know, we know from the Joseph Boyden incident that his next step was to move forward and then go to elders and began lobbying them and in a very pushy way to reclaim and salvage his identity and his celebrity that he received from writing as an Indigenous author when he, in fact, was not Indigenous.
In fact, I know someone who was specifically asked to introduce him as an Indigenous identity at an event, and when she went to clarify with him that some of it seemed confusing and she wanted to double check, he in fact doubled down and had her add another Indigenous identity to the introduction. It was hugely embarrassing and puts other people in an extremely uncomfortable position who are Indigenous.
Yes, it actually, what happens is it creates internal conflict within communities. So we then don't know. We don't want to overstep anybody else's cultural boundaries. We don't want to overstep other people's protocols and rules. So it actually pits us against each other. We then begin to recess into a symptom of like, are you really Native? And so we actually use this philosophy against each other because we no longer trust. What happens when somebody overtly steals something from you, like your land, your culture, your territory? Another aspect is the identity that's yours. And so we're still, as a community, reeling from feeling unsafe, not sure, where do we go? Do we have a solution? Our community is struggling to figure out how we make sense of this into the future. And while we're doing this, she is actively seeking, and I can tell you that if Joseph Boyden did it, she's going to do it as well, because this is the next step, evolutionary step, that we've seen happen with non-Indigenous people assuming Indigenous identity, is they then go to our elders, the most sympathetic, kind seniors who really don't have an understanding of what's going on, because a lot of them aren't on social media, they're not on the internet, they're not familiar with the story. And so the further exploitation of elders and seniors to support her career is horrifying. I can't even believe, and I know that that's going to happen because that's what happens every time.
And it's, I guess, as you're kind of describing it, an exploitation of their kindness. Elders tend to want to welcome, tend to want to teach. I know I'm white, and I've received many teachings and gifts from elders as a white person myself that are so generously given. I would never imagine to go and ask them to help validate me in some way. That's exploitative.
Well, you know what? Elders are so kind and so nice and so wanting to help you that this type of secondary act is yet another injury to our Indigenous people. That's why in the press, in my statement, I specifically requested her, do not go to our elders and put them in a compromising position, because their family then has to figure out what to do. And it's so incredibly manipulative and psychopathic. And I worry for the elders that she's in communication with, and how she's fast-tracking relationships with Indigenous nations in order to salvage her own career. So that's another one of my concerns.
Now, Latimer, in a statement, apologized for the division that this has caused and said that, as an artist of mixed Indigenous and settler ancestry, I know it is my responsibility to be clear and direct about my personal history and ancestral ties, but said that she did have that single line of connection. How, in your view, I know that the huge debate this set off in social media, some people worried that people who don't have a connection to their immediate community are worried that this might end up being kind of like a blood quantum test of some sort. How do you respond to that? And what are those, how do you see the nuances of that debate?
Well, there are issues about connection. There are issues because that connection has been broken in many, many cases because of genocide. I have yet to see a case of somebody who is truly Indigenous. And once you hear the story of, I was part of the 60s scoop, they are openly welcomed into the community. I actually hired a girl who was adopted to a white family, got reintegrated into the Native community, and I hired her at my Native business, and she married a Native man, and she's fully integrated into the community. ID and validation is not even necessary for her, but I'm telling you, if she mistakenly did something, I would vouch for her in a second, and so would a lot of Native people. So, you know what, there are circumstances. You don't always have to have identification or a DNA test to prove that you are Indigenous. Being Indigenous means, even the story she had on Entertainment Tonight where she was talking about racism, she said she was standing there watching a racist incident with another Native guy take place, and she was mortified. I've been in racist incidents with other Native people, and I'm not watching. I'm defending. I'm on that team. Even that statement shows that she was not Indigenous, because you're either on that team or you're not. And I would be on the Native team going, hold on a minute here. If you fight her, you're going to have to fight me too, because I'm Native. And we're all going to go down as a group.
And more than likely not would have been a target as well if somebody was being racist, if one is Indigenous.
Yes. And you know what? People don't know what I am sometimes, and I self-declare as Indigenous all the time. When I went to, I traveled to a lot of other Indigenous communities. One of the best experiences I had was in the South, was in South Dakota. And I was hanging out with a bunch of people down there. They were all incredibly nice and kind, and they immediately took me into their place. They're like, you can stay here. So they test you. They say they want to see how Native you are. So they ask two fundamental questions about who you are. Number one, where are you from? Even if you're a part of a 60s scoop, you know where you're from, because it's a part of your identification. That kind of information is available. And so you can say, this is where I'm from, and then your secondary question is, what is your clan? Those are the two simple questions that Michelle Latimer should have been asked even before she got one job.
You've used the phrase, and I've heard this elsewhere, to be claimed by a community. Can you say more about that? What does that mean, to be claimed?
Well, I'll give you an example, is that I was visiting Kitimat, and at the time, my boyfriend was non-Native, but I just became a part of the community. I would volunteer. I would go into the community. I'd hang around. Eventually I got adopted into the community because my heart was very available. So whenever I was around, I would always be helping. I got claimed in South Dakota by the South Dakota, a family down there who said, you're welcome to come back anytime and we see you as family. Very common when you are a part of the Native community that they bring you into their community and you become a part of a fold. And this is the part that is incredibly important. If you're integrated, or even if you're even a little bit Native, this is very common practice. The fact that nobody claimed her meant that she had very few ties to the Native community. And Glenn Gould openly stated on Facebook it was commonly known she wasn't Native.
Obviously, you've mentioned Joseph Boyden, Michelle Latimer. I can think of many other cases. I went down to California years back, like a decade ago, and actually stayed with Andrea Smith, who turned out to also not be Indigenous, but was considered one of the leading political theorists on Indigenous identity and Christianity. Turned out also fraudulent. And it seems like this is a very common thing. I know the Cherokee Nation has had this huge problem in the States for years with this.
Yes, it's a huge, huge problem. I just received an email last night from a doctor who said that as long as you click Native American, you can get tons of money in academia. I just received another email from Santa Fe just a few minutes ago saying, this is such a huge problem, and we don't have people making official statements because they don't know how to handle it. We haven't come up with a system of how to handle this, and we haven't pursued it. And then she said, I love what you're doing because so many people pretend to be Native and they're not, and they benefit from it economically. It happens all the time. If you look at Chloe Angus, her husband was Métis. She put in her paperwork, they did a CBC article, that all of a sudden she started applying for money as an Indigenous person in order to get money. And this is a very common problem. It happens constantly in the Native community. And like in the Black community where they said, you're no longer allowed to use the N-word, this is a line in the sand for us saying, no longer are you allowed to be able to use Indigenous identity without qualifying it.
One aspect that I wanted to ask you about is just the difference in experience between someone who's a quote-unquote pretendian and someone who's actually experienced the discrimination and barriers and struggle through them to the point where they're an artist or a creator or a public person.
One thing we have in common with other Indigenous people globally is a famous artist once said this from New Zealand. She was Maori, and she said this to me, we see eye to eye because we both have shared the struggle. You know, I'm half Indigenous. My mother was Haida, and I remember when we went to school in North Vancouver at Ross Road, we would do, and I'll give you a classic racist example of how difficult it was to navigate being Indigenous. And we would get to the edge of the school ground, and all the kids would come running in a group, and they'd come like rage-filled like little monsters. They'd come running towards us, and then we would brace ourselves. And we were little. We were in kindergarten, grade one. And we'd have to brace ourselves. The entire school would wait for us, and we'd have to run the gauntlet. So our goal was to get from the edge of the playground to the school and get in that door where the teachers could hopefully protect us. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't, because we were considered Indigenous. Even though we're half, and probably out of all my sisters, I was the most fair. Nobody would have known what I was, but we self-declared as Indigenous. When we would run, the kids would then grab us and tear our clothes, they'd tear our jackets, and they would gather stones. And one day, this one kid grabbed a huge stone, and it was just a big boulder. And he put my sister down, who was my oldest sister, and smashed her in the head with it over and over and over again. And it was like a siege upon us. And this happened every single day.
I'm so sorry. That is awful.
That was just life. That's what it was like living as an Indigenous person. My son was just in elementary school, and last year he got into a fight with a little Asian boy, and it wasn't his fault, but the teacher, he self-declared as Indigenous. He has since he started that school. The teacher, during recess, they got into a tussle. Nobody knew whose fault it was. They're boys. They fight all the time. She had a choice as to whether she was going to choose boy number A or my son. She took my son, she grabbed him, threw him to the ground, put her adult body on my 10-year-old son, laid her arms across him till he couldn't breathe, and held him down. And that's just the trauma we experience just growing up in Canada. She wouldn't have experienced that. She was part of the ones who were participating. So how could she, you know, she can't be shielded. The other thing that you do as an Indigenous woman, I remember hearing a story, and this is what I just finished telling Angela, was that I remember growing up knowing that my aunt, who was a librarian, was one of the murdered and missing women. And I remember as a very young woman thinking, if I go missing, nobody will notice. You think, Michelle Latimer had to think that? No, she's never had to think that. She's part of the dominant culture. If she went missing, it would be on every news report in the country. You'd have thousands of people looking for her. If I went missing, I'd probably be at the bottom of an ocean and nobody wouldn't even care. We have completely different realities. Nobody shielded me from the trauma of being called an Indian or being called a dirty whore or being called a savage. Nobody protected me from that. You know, nobody protected me from being assaulted or beaten up because I was Native. So she's not had any of those experiences. And by her declaring Indigenous ancestry, she cheapens all of our experiences of survival over the past 500 years.
I wanted to read you something from Eden Robinson, one of the best writers and novelists in the country from Heiltsuk and Haisla Nation. And she's the person who wrote the Trickster books that the show was based on and approved of and selected Latimer to direct this show. And she said in a post on Facebook, "I feel like such a dupe. I don't know how to deal with the anger, disappointment, and stress." And she actually apologized to the community that the novel was set in.
Our entire community, after this trauma, again, another theft. I don't know if you've ever been robbed. The feeling that's existing in today's Indigenous community is the same feeling you have when you've been violated and something's been taken from you that's incredibly valuable. And we all don't know what to do with that. We all don't know how to handle it. You know, this is one of the things I've said is that we don't know how to deal with it because the gatekeepers are taking responsibility. They're saying, we're really sorry. The one person who should be taking accountability at this very moment, Michelle Latimer, is now trying to prove more of her Indigenousness. You know, she has been 100% unaccountable for what she's done. She has not publicly made or issued a statement or really fully understands what she's done.
Can you tell me about this Indigenous Identity Act that you're proposing? What kind of gave you the idea this was a good approach to this? And what's the gist of what it's trying to do?
The Indigenous Identity Act would be legislation that will hold people accountable for misrepresenting themselves. So there would be consequences, number one. Otherwise, there's no teeth to any of this. So the Indian and Arts Crafts Act in the United States, which was drafted in 1934 and revised in 1990, punishes people for infractions. It's a $250,000 fine or a 5-year prison sentence or both. First time offense, it's one or the other. And so they have prosecuted people. It's a wide legislation that prevents people from destroying the cultural traditions and the resources that artists use all across America to produce artwork and culture and traditions. So it has been incredibly useful. The Indian Identity Act is something similar, but it would across all aspects of Canadian society, academia, the arts, cinema, where if you promote yourself to have Indigenous identity, you must be validated with some kind of evidence. You can't self-declare yourself as Indigenous without having connections or ties to a community, and it has to be legitimate. And I've been to my sister's law school, and I would say 70% of the UBC students at the law school when she was attending were not Indigenous.
Have you been to the Assembly of First Nations headquarters?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a lot of organizations where when you look at them and you see them and then you try to interact with the people in an Indigenous way, you know they're not Indigenous because there's nothing remotely Native about them. Just like the Black community, we have our own nuances and our own style of being. That would have been a tell with Michelle Latimer for me immediately.
Do you think that your Indigenous Identity Act, if it is approved or some form of it's taking it up, could help prevent people from accessing public funds from things like the Canadian Media Fund or Telefilm, National Film Board, CBC, that kind of thing?
Yes, I think that the reason why we don't have the correct vetting of circumstances is that we have too many people who are not Native in these organizations who really are a fabric of the community. So basically I'm saying they're checking boxes and they don't really fit in.
What's the next steps for this legislation? I understand you're talking to a senator, potentially could introduce it in the Senate?
Yes, I'm talking to two senators, one senator in particular, and we're going to see what we can do about drafting the legislation. Basically, I would work with a team of people to create a framework, and then once it becomes a framework, it then would go to, you know, the Senate, and they would have their own people draft legislation and see if it'd be possible to pass it. I think the climate is right for this type of legislation, and I think our community needs something in response to all of this stealing. It's just horrible.
And how would you respond if somebody sort of said, well, it's a good idea, but it's having an identity legislation could potentially be unconstitutional or raise sort of questions about how you'd prove it? What would you say to those people?
There is legislation in the states already that exists, and it already has been legislation that's been in place now for a very long time. That legislation has been effective. Not only effective, but it's also they've prosecuted people and they've used that legislation to maintain a kind of authenticity in every aspect of the Indigenous arts community. And it's self-policing. I was at an event and there was somebody there that obviously was non-Native and all the artists were talking about, yeah, did you see that girl down there? And then eventually the organizers asked her, you know, we need to qualify you to see if you are Indigenous, and as it turned out, she wasn't, and they asked her to leave, and she left. So it does work. I've seen it work in real time. I mean, basically, from the very foundation, she lied from the very beginning. She misrepresented herself. She took up space for a community. Can you, like, the audacity of it to go to a marginalized community struggling economically and take up space there? It is so unethical. And many people have said, I like her, she's really nice. It doesn't matter. Ignorance of the law doesn't mean that you can just ignore the law. You shouldn't be doing things that you shouldn't be doing. You shouldn't be lying about your identity.
Before we close, Tamara, I wanted to ask, do you have any hopes for how this might help kind of advance the conversation within First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities in this country? What's your hope for that in terms of talking about these issues?
I hope that this conversation is a dividing line in the sand, just like the N-word, where we say, no more, not anymore, not on my watch.
Thank you so much for your time and sharing your efforts with our listeners.
Okay, no problem. Thank you so much.
Take good care. And that was Haida filmmaker Tamara Bell, who has a show on Aboriginal People's Television Network.
And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.